So as I recall, we did not get through the overview. So I don't remember where we left off. If someone can help me. I know we got through 14 to 5, 1 to 5. Well, actually, we weren't going through chapter verse by verse, but I don't remember if we really finished the overview. You don't think so? Yeah, I don't think so either. I think we talked mostly about the sealing or the name of the Father and the forehead. But I don't think we covered the three angels in our
Not a
overview.
whole lot.
Just started.
Why don't we read the three angels? And Nancy, would you be willing to do that for us?
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, so I'll read from Free Bible Version, Revelation 14, beginning in verse 6 with the first angel. And it's the message of the three angels. Then I witnessed another angel flying in the sky, carrying a message of eternal good news to announce to the earth, to every tribe, language, nation. With a loud voice, he shouted, "You must reverence God and glorify him for the," oh, I said Free Bible. It's actually the Passion. Sorry, but I'll keep reading in the Passion translation. "You
Okay.
must reverence God and glorify him, for the time has come for him to judge. Worship at the feet of the Creator of heaven, earth, sea, and springs of water." Then a second angel followed, declaring, "She fell. She fell. Babylon the Great is fallen. She once seduced the nations and made them all drink the wine of the passion of her harlotry." Then a third angel followed them, shouting with a mighty voice, "Whoever worships the wild beast in its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand will also drink the wine of God's wrath. This wine has been poured out and mixed in the cup of his indignation. They will be tormented with sulfur and fire in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their severe suffering ascends into ages upon ages. Those who worship the wild beast in its image and receive the mark of its name will have no rest, day or night. This is the call for endurance and faithfulness of the holy believers, those who follow God's command and cling to the faith of Jesus." Now it's kind of different. I'd probably like Free Bible Version better, but whatever.
Yeah, there were a few things that I felt had
Okay.
overtones of the sovereignty of God
Yes.
doctrine so popular among evangelicals.
Do you want me to read in Free Bible?
Oh, you don't have to. We can modify it in our ears and our brains. I said this several weeks ago, but Nancy and Brad, I don't think you were here.
No doubt.
I suggested that the three angels' messages are have a distinct order that is deliberate. And do you remember that?
Say more, and then I can say yes or no.
Okay. The first angel is all we need. If we get the first angel, do you remember now? Okay, so you were here.
Remember that part,
I remember that part.
but continue, please, for my
Yeah.
memory.
Well, I think bears repeating, so I'll just repeat it. The first angel is what we really need, and if we get that message and we embed it in our hearts and minds, then we don't need the second or third, unless it is for understanding the future. But the second man angel's message is for those who reject the first angel's message. Because if they've rejected the first angel's message, they're in Babylon. And so they need to come out. And if they reject the first, second angel's message, then God has to raise his voice and sound the third angel. Because they won't hear or accept anything else but a loud voice. I had a grandfather who was like that. He grew up in a family of eight children. And they all talked loud because they had to be heard. And they all had to talk. You know? There wasn't a single one, I think, except maybe the girls in the family who were more on the quiet side. And so if you wanted to get grandpa's attention, you had to talk loud. And also, of course, he was deaf. But it really felt like you had to scream at him in order for him to listen to anything you had to say. Especially my mother felt that way. And so I see the third angel's message as God raising his voice, trying to get their attention, trying to warn them of the consequences, which, of course, are inevitable and intrinsic if they reject the first two messages.
That makes sense.
It has helped me to come to terms with what's going on in this threesome, as the early Adventists used to call it, the threefold message.
The first angel's message fits God's commandments. Thou shalt have no other God before me. Kind of written right in there. Fear God, give him glory. Worship the one who has made heaven and earth, sea and the springs of water.
And of course, other versions say, for the hour of his judgment has come. Mm-hmm. Instead of him judging us, we're judging him. So I like the other translations better. Mm-hmm. But that makes sense. Gina, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying the first message is enough, but God continues to do more and continues to do more to try to reach people where they are.
Yeah.
So if louder voices, louder voices, if there needs to be a little fear in there of the ultimate consequences, he'll use whatever he can to try to save people.
Something just occurred to me looking at this from that bigger perspective. I'm always looking for patterns that gel in the whole book. And there are three sets of sevens that are unpacked anyway. And I'm wondering, now my curious is, would these three messages align with those three sets of sevens? Because,
well, it would depend on what those sevens were.
Well, you got the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven bowls. I mean, there's other sevens, but they're not unpacked. Like the seven, seven thunders.
I don't know, because there's the number three in throughout Revelation. Mm-hmm. That's significant, and it usually is a Trinitarian
mm-hmm.
number. So you have the false Trinity and you have the true Trinity.
But in this case, you're talking about a three-stage, you know, emphasis that if you don't get the first one, you have to take another one. And if you don't get that one, you get one more chance, kind of thing. And that's how I've actually seen those three sets of sevens. Not that the seven and the three have anything to do with each other, but there's three sets.
Maybe they're principles. They're all based on the same principle.
So I see the first round of sevens as, well, you know, he's breaking open the real issues, you know, bringing them out in the open, which the first angel is bringing out in the open. Well, it's not so much focusing on the problem, but in a sense it is, but it's doing it in a positive way. And it's saying, you know, what you're lacking here is an appreciation for the one who created you. So if you would just do that, that would be great. And yeah, you wouldn't need any more. And then the trumpets is pretty serious. And it really does start exposing all the negativity in the counterfeit kingdom. But it's still somewhat muted because everything is thirds all the way through the trumpets. You know, there's lots and lots and lots of thirds. When you get to the bowls, there's no more thirds. You got many of the very same elements talked about in the same sequence, but there's no more thirds. It's all out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's completely all out, which to me does in some respects parallel these three increasingly urgent messages.
It could in at least in principle, mm-hmm. all tie together. I see these, because the false trinity in this chapter, I mean the false trinity in Revelation, is really a counterfeit. And because it is about power all the way through, instead of coming up with this is the real Trinity, God gives three messages indicating that the Trinity is not about power, but about meaning, about message, about character. And I see that as an important lesson, because there's really nowhere in Revelation where you can succinctly say, this is the Trinity. You can put it together loosely throughout Revelation, but there's no place where it's clear. No single place. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of, maybe this is like a tree with many branches or something. Different ways you can look at this. I was trying to think if there was something else as an overview for me to show in terms of these three messages.
Might I say one thing while you're doing that?
Sure.
Also in the context, what you were talking about, one building on two, building on three. And the text says the first angel's message just an announce. He announces the message. Second angel calling out. And then in a third angel is crying out in a loud voice, calling out very loud. So it gets louder and louder, like you're talking about.
Right.
Or we call it yelling.
Yeah.
But that's in keeping with if these three messages are a progression for those who reject the first message, then the second message, and you have the third.
So the first one really is very in tune with the new song motif. It's all positive. It's all about praising and giving glory and thanksgiving, which is what the new song paradigm is.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't practice that, if you don't accept it, if you don't live it, if that's not what form is forming your character, then it has to be more urgent in saying, well, there's a problem here. And you need to understand what the problem is. And that is that this whole counterfeit system is bankrupt. And it's like, okay, there is a problem here. And if I have to tell you, let me explain what the problem is. It's the system, you know, leads to death. You know, it looks like it works, this legal system, but in the end, it's bankrupt. It doesn't produce what it promises. But if that doesn't get you back to the first message, to living under the new song, there's only one more attempt. And that is, okay, if I really have to tell you what the consequences are of staying in Babylon, then I'm going to have to be blunt. You're never going to have rest. You're going to be tormented when you come into the presence of love.
Mm-hmm.
And that torment's never going to stop unless you choose to check out.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to get more and more blunt, but there's no more that God can do. I'm going through the bowls right now in chapter 16. In fact, I was just working on it when we started the call. And I just keep seeing more and more and more and more things coming out of that study that I've never noticed before. And again, it's the last attempt that actually ends up proving that there is nothing else that can be done. There's no one willing to change their mind. But you have to go through that last round of appeals to prove that there's nothing left. It's like the gleaning process. And when you've gotten every last grain there is left, there's nothing left. But that has to be proven. has to be demonstrated. And this last angel's message is really describing what we see in the bowls.
Yeah.
Is the torment and the blasphemy and all that stuff. That's what's being described here. It really does parallel. I know why I hadn't seen that before, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I've long seen the process of the end taking place. That I used to be bothered by Ellen White's talk about God's wrath in Revelation, in the Great Controversy. I didn't know how to reinterpret it. And then I realized one day it was my friend, because she says, not one person is made to suffer the wrath of God as long as there is any hope of their salvation. He will not leave them without adequate evidence, evidence that appeals to their reasoning powers. I'm not quoting her now. I'm just saying how that process works out. But it seems to me that what we have here is heaven's last attempt to make sure that they haven't left anyone out that wants salvation.
There you go.
This is good evidence for the thing I have talked about here, I think, before, that a big aha for me in my relationship with God was realizing that nobody is ever going to be lost by accident.
Mm-mm.
They're not going to be lost because they didn't know, or they had some mental block or anything else. They're going to be out of the kingdom because that's what they wanted.
Yeah. And I think that the suffering of God's people in persecution is going to be the result of that long protracted attempt to save every person possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because what better witness is there about who God is than a person who is suffering for that very belief and how they behave in that very belief and during that time process of suffering? It's one of the ways God has of trying to make the picture clear, I think.
It's interesting too, when Floyd, you mentioned Revelation 16, so I was just scanning it and under the fifth bowl, it's interesting that it's the bowls poured out on the beast's throne. There's darkness over his kingdom. Again, you know, literal, figuratively. The people bit their tongues because of the pain they felt, and they cursed the God of heaven because of their pain and their sores. But they did not repent and stop what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, that could be a turning point. Pain can be a turning point for people, this, you know, this awareness. But they just stay in their darkness and curse God, and there's no change. Nothing changes.
And if anything,
they're more determined that they're right, because the God that is doing this is a cruel God.
Yeah.
That's how they see him.
That's how they see it.
And that's the content of their blasphemy. And there's two bowls in a row where they blaspheme God. And they refuse to repent. And it hit me one day when I was looking at it, it's like, wait a minute. It says they're blaspheming. And what they're saying is God's behind this. So that must be the blasphemy. Why are we teaching that God's behind this? We're joining them in blasphemy.
Yeah, good point. I don't
think that's a good idea.
Well, Gene,
so too. Now we're starting to look more at specifics. Do we want to turn from the overview? Have we finished the overview, do you think?
No.
Okay. Go ahead,
Nancy. Look at the two harvests.
Oh, yeah, we do need to look at the harvest. But go ahead, Nancy. I think you have more.
Yeah, that's the part we hadn't covered. But what would you say? So we talked a little bit about Babylon collapse into ruin. And we know the other, where's the other part in Revelation? Where it says, come out of her.
Chapter 18. Chapter 18 is all on Babylon.
So that's always good to remember as you're looking at this, because this is the kind of the summary, and then you get more details later about God's plea to come out, come out. I don't want you to. It's imminently going to collapse. This building is condemned. It's coming down. So get out. And anyway, so what would you say the overview of the third angel is? Because that's, you know.
I would like to first back up on Babylon and say another piece of overview.
Okay, sure.
That coming out of Babylon is not coming out necessarily of a particular denomination or a particular institution or a particular whatever. It's out of a certain picture of God.
Yes.
Yep.
A Babylonian picture of God.
Yep.
That's it. So,
you know, that's key though, because we've always been taught that Babylon is a specific institution. Yep. At least I was.
Well, we were taught because that's how the early believers viewed it as they left their churches.
Yes.
They viewed their churches as Babylon. And that's appropriate. I mean, in that setting, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
But I think it's safer because this is for the whole world. You know, it's amazing how early Adventists tended to view everything within America.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we're past that. We're not in that situation anymore. We're looking at the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's not try to pick one denomination and say, let's get out of that denomination. There's many denominations and they may all be Babylonian.
Right, right. And
so it's
more
better
than, what I'm saying though is it's more than denominations even. If it's a mindset, that belongs to atheists, that belongs to Muslims, that belongs
absolutely
to non-religious people. That is a humanity issue, not even a religious issue.
Right.
Well, and if God's true church is his followers, there's no religion in that. There's no denomination in that. It's his group of people who are committed to him, and they're his followers. And Satan would have any and everybody else, denominations included.
Well, that's true that the followers of the Lamb are not stipulated as belonging to a prescribed church.
Right.
They're the followers of the Lamb.
Right.
Which means that they're responding to the spirit of gentleness, of kindness, of humility, of compassion. They're reflecting in their spirit the spirit of God that is prompting them, regardless of whether they even know there is a God.
Well, and they're teachable and trainable.
Yeah.
They're interested in truth and love.
And most of the people I've seen who insist that they're part of the 144,000 are pretty much at the other extreme.
Yeah.
And it's all about performance and perfection and keeping the rules.
So maybe we should look at the harvest, because if there's such a thing as perfect, you know, if there's perfection, this is where it lies in Revelation. So let's look at the harvest. The harvest only comes when the earth is ripe.
Hmm.
Sorry, before we went to the harvest, I was just thinking the phrase, come out of her, my people. If he's speaking to his followers, come out of her, my people, could that mean come out of believing the lies about me? Come out of your cherished or man-made tradition.
Yeah, I'd like to say, well, maybe I should say it now, unless I forget it. The come out of her, my people, seems to be a universal call, does it not?
Right.
And let's face it, every human being has at one point in their life, if not currently, held to a picture of God that is very Babylonian.
Yes. Yes.
In origin. As the Babylonian, you could argue that maybe the Egyptian religion also influenced things, but Babylon influenced Greece, it influenced Rome. And there are many beliefs in evangelical Christianity alone, to say nothing of other Christian groups, that are very Babylonian. So, yeah, I would say, and this is a call to the world to come out of the Babylonian origin of all that's evil and all that's against the character of God.
Founded on lies.
And do we in part base that the Babylon as we go back to Revelation 13 with the dragon and the beast, you know, so he has 10 horns, 7 heads, the crowns, and then in this amalgamation, the leopard, you know, look like the leopard, feet like a bear, but his mouth like that of a lion, you know, and again, this, you know, who's behind, you know, his power, his throne, his authority, you know, wouldn't that be the anti-God and the acceptance of this distorted view of God that religions have? But the, you know, the, that speaking, that's the best way. I mean, that's the clearest way to understand something. If somebody speaks, it's way easier to understand, right? So he's speaking with the mouth of a lion. And doesn't the lion represent Babylon with the beast?
Mm-mm.
It doesn't at all.
You're going back to 13.
So what do you think the lion that speaks, is that, does that have connection to what is being said about
Are
God?
You getting the lion is, there's no lion in Daniel, is there?
Well, no, I'm seeing Revelation 13.
Well,
you know, Revelation 13, yeah. But I mean, there's a lion head, like, but I'm talking about where is the antecedent for that lion head to be Babylon? Is it in Daniel?
I'm trying to remember.
Well, there was a similar amalgamated beast in Daniel, but I'm not, I don't
seven,
currently remember completely. There might have been a lion involved there. Or is it Daniel 7?
That's what I'm thinking is Daniel 7.
I just haven't memorized all that.
There is, okay, here it is. First was like a lion with eagle's wings.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That was Daniel. It would be Babylon. Right?
That was Babylon. Wings torn off. Then he stands up and speaks like a man, you know, which is interesting.
And then
the number of a man.
Anyways. There was another beast, this one like a leopard.
The bear.
And then the fourth beast was hideous and terrifying, extraordinary power with massive iron teeth as it ate and crushed its feet and smashed whatever was left over. Had
but,
10 horns.
But was that lion with wings, was that Babylon or was that Medo-Persia?
I think it is Medo-Persia.
Well, I thought it was the second beast is Medo-Persia. The bear, you know, hunched up on one side, 3 ribs in its mouth. I thought that was.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right.
And the Greece.
So you have Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Rome.
Rome, the.
But where's Greece?
So I was.
Oh, wait a minute. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. Isn't that Greece?
I thought Greece was the leopard with 4 wings. You know, the 4 generals, leopard, fast, speed. And I thought the fourth beast was Rome.
Well, the fourth beast definitely is Rome. But the 3 other beasts would have to be.
That to be Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. Yeah.
So that's why I was just saying, going to whistle.
So the lion would be Babylon.
Yeah, that's what my brain, and I missed your previous discussion about that.
I didn't go there. That I don't think in the previous discussion. This is the first time we've talked about it.
So I thought it was interesting. Again, we have. No, a mouse, and it's a lion's mouth. So I connected that to Babylon.
The lion of the
Which is
hunt.
Again interesting. Yeah,
there's all kinds of things about lions in
we have the
mostly
lion
Assyria.
Yeah.
Mostly Assyria. You had the Colossus, the lions on at the gate of the palace. I believe it was.
Just out of curiosity, what has been the historical relationship or interaction Assyria was headquartered in Nineveh, right?
Not always. They later became headquartered in Asshur.
Okay,
In the
but
Neo-Babylon, in the
what was
Neo-Assyrian
their
period.
interactions and relationship with Babylon? They never took
Well,
over Babylon, did they?
yes, they did.
Under who?
Yes, they did.
When?
Sennacherib. Sennacherib destroyed Babylon.
What time frame was that?
That's the first millennia. That's what we call the Neo-Babylonian, Neo-Assyrian period.
So was that before Daniel's time?
First millennium. Yes, it would be before Daniel. It was during the time of Hezekiah. Or closer to the time period of Hezekiah.
So in what condition was Babylon in during that time period? Did it have all the same fortifications and everything, or was it Nebuchadnezzar who made
Well, you know,
Babylon great?
You can read that he destroyed Babylon, but then the next king raises Babylon back up. So I don't know how much rebuilding they had to do. I don't know how extensive the destruction was, but they immobilized Babylon, certainly, in terms of being any kind of superpower.
So Babylon was conquered by Assyria, but not necessarily taken over or run
Well,
by
it was
Assyria.
taken over by Assyria.
But
Assyria
did they like
dominated
set
Babylon.
up operations there? Because most of the next
Yes.
kingdoms,
They
so I mean,
determined who was
Medo-Persia
king.
set up their headquarters there, didn't they?
Well, now you're talking Medo-Persia. I'm still back in Babylon.
I know, I
The
know.
Medo-Persia is still in the future. This is
Right.
the Assyrian, the first, the what is it called? The late Assyrian period.
So, but Assyria never had their headquarters at Babylon, I guess is my point.
No, they don't. Whereas after Nebuchadnezzar,
Yeah.
then you have that, but that's after
Right,
Sennacherib,
right.
way after
Right.
Sennacherib.
So the headquarters, as far as Babylon being headquarters, was only for Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. And Medo-Persia, who had their king evidently at Babylon, but Greece never, you know, used
Okay,
Babylon.
Here's the story on Greece. Alexander the Great came to Babylon and they opened the gates and said, "Come in and be our king." He had no, there was no war, there was no opposition, absolutely nothing. And so he walks in, takes the throne. And then the Baru priests started working on the omens. What are the omens for this new king? And all the omens suggested the gods were angry with Alexander, and they were going to remove him or kill him or see that he got killed. And so the Baru priests approached Alexander the Great, and they said, "Alexander," or they said, "O king," probably, "O king, the omens of the gods say that they are going to get rid of you and you're going to lose your life. May we please do a substitute king ritual for you?" Alexander said, "No, I don't need a substitute king ritual." He died in Babylon.
So that
That's
was
a piece of story that I had never heard correctly. I'd always heard that he got in a big drinking spree with his army, and he died, you know, of cirrhosis of the liver or whatever. But that's the story I have in a book called Cyrus to Alexander. It's in the very last few pages of that book that it tells that story.
So in that
Makes it.
sequence, Assyria destroys Babylon, whatever that means, but they never used it as a headquarters.
Not as their headquarters, but they used it as a how do I want to put it?
Like
A
an
vassal.
outpost?
A vassal.
Okay.
A vassal that was like an outpost, and they dominated it by putting their own king in Babylon.
who is a sub-king to the one in Assyria.
Yeah.
So the king of Assyria did not rule from Babylon, is what I'm saying.
Exactly.
Okay. But then when, and I don't know how it transitioned from them to the Babylonians, but at some point you had Babylonian Babylons who must not have no longer been Assyrian, and they did rule in Babylon and I guess made Babylon great again. And then Medo-Persia comes along. Where was Medo-Persia's headquarters before they came to Babylon?
In Persia, Susa.
And they set up a king in Babylon. Did they move their king to Babylon? Because did they rule from Babylon?
Let me go get my book.
Just looking up some facts on Alexander the Great. He died at age 32.
Yeah.
In Babylon. Cause of death they have listed as typhoid fever. I don't know how accurate this is.
I'm sorry. I have completely read this book. Then a part of my library. My library is all through my house. I have books in my kitchen. I have books in my dining room. I have books around my living room. I have books in my study and books in all bedrooms. It's crazy. Anyway, I would guess by means of the geographic variety of the structures listed, Cyrus was primarily proclaiming his intention of taking over all the territories of his vanquished kingdom. His statement also allowed him to relegate the reign of Nabonidus to the forgotten pages of history. So the text, the Cyrus cylinder, he did some research in Assyria, no less. And the Ashurbanipal is one of his predecessors. He thinks, Cyrus thinks that. He also claimed at the beginning of his reign, he had brought the statue of Marduk back to Babylon. It had been taken, I believe, by the Elamites. Elamites were proto-Persians. For his part, Cyrus offered himself not as a conquering outsider, but as a legitimate king coming to mend the thread of ancient Babylonian history. Well, he recalled that he was the son of the great king Cambyses, king of the city of Anshan, grandson of the great king Cyrus, king of the city of Anshan, great-grandson of the great king Tiaspus, king of Anshan. He also presented him in the following way. I am Cyrus, king of the world, great king, powerful king, king of Babylon, king of the country of Sumer, and Akkad, king of the four corners of the earth. It's possible he did stay at Babylon. That would seem to indicate it.
So we have three of these empires who at least the last one was a pretty short period of time, but all of them ruled from the location of Babylon.
Exactly. And of course,
but Assyria did not.
Great, only a very brief time.
But Assyria did not do that.
As far as I know, not.
Okay.
And I've read enough, I think I would have seen it if they had ruled from Babylon.
Okay. And obviously Rome did not.
Right. Rome is out of that picture.
Now, what is the relationship of Rome to Babylon? Did they ever go to Babylon and conquer it, or did they just ignore it?
Babylon infiltrated Rome through Greece.
Explain that.
For example, Zeus in Greece is Marduk in Babylon. Jupiter in Rome is Marduk in Babylon.
So their theology infects Rome.
The theology is similar. It's hard to know. This is one of the things that's in my back of my head of something I want to research out more carefully. But I have the beginnings of that research in several articles in the Civilizations of the Ancient Near East book that has the spread of Babylon westward, there was a lot of similarities. Of course, Greece had a much more advanced system of governance than Babylon. But religiously, I think there are more similarities than politically.
Now, after Alexander died in Babylon, and what there were like four generals that took over,
that took his place. Mm-hmm.
Did any of those stay in Babylon?
I believe one of them did.
Okay, so one of them did.
I believe so. I haven't, it's been a while since I've read about that. But
now, when Rome comes along and conquers Greece, however that happened, did they ever send troops to Babylon?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I think Babylon ended about the time Greece came to an end as a world leader. Because the late Babylonian period, let me see if
Babylon keeps showing up. I mean, you know, I do not understand or have never been schooled in ancient civilizations, world history. Just didn't get that. So it's interesting, though. It keeps showing up, keeps showing up, keeps showing up. And I thought it's fascinating what you said about, you know, and Jennings has mentioned this as well, how those gods change names, but there's, you know, they're borrowed from all these different nation states and world powers, just adopt them, tweak them a little bit, but they continue forward in their, you know, characteristics, manifestations.
Chameleons.
Here is the list. So you have the Chaldean dynasty, which is Nebuchadnezzar or Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar II, evil Merodach, Nergiglycer, Labashi, Marduk, Nabonidus. Okay. Then Cyrus II, Cambyses II, Bardiya, Nebuchadnezzar III, Nebuchadnezzar IV, Darius I, Xerxes I, Baal-Shemani, Shamash, Ereba, Artaxerxes I, Darius II, Artaxerxes II, Memnon, Artaxerxes III, Ochus, Arsis, and Darius III. Now we come to the Macedonian rulers, which are Alexander III the Great, Philip Archidius. So apparently somebody, maybe his son, maybe one of his officers, took his place. Alexander the Fourth. And then you have the Seleucid dynasty, and that's Greek. Actually, Macedonia is too, but it's Macedonia. So Alexander the Great apparently was Macedonian, not Greek specifically. You have Antiochus the First Soter, Antiochus the Second Theos, Seleucus the Second Callinicus, Seleucus the Third Soter, Antiochus the Third Great, Antiochus the, okay, Seleucus Philopater, Antiochus Epiphanes, well known in Jewish history, Antiochus the Fifth Eupator, Demetrius the First Soter, Alexander Balas Barbellus, Demetrius the Second Nicator, or Nicator, Antiochus the Sixth Epiphanes, not the same as Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus the Seventh Sidatus, Demetrius the Second Nicator, or Nicator, Alexander the Second Zabinus, Antiochus the Eighth Griffus, Seleucus the Fifth, and then over here under Parthian or Arsacid dynasty, Mithridates the Second, and that's the end of Babylon. So Rome never had anything to do with Babylon. Babylon was gone.
And what happened? I mean, I know in prophecy it talks about the annihilation of Babylon, that it'll never be inhabited again. When did that happen, at the last one you just read?
I don't know. I have never been able to follow that one through. But it's interesting that you bring this question, Floyd, because Babylon dominated all the kings of Babylon. Of all the kings, only the Isin period, the second Isin period, were actually Babylonian. In the old Babylonian period, you have the first dynasty of Babylon, which is Amorite, including Hammurabi, the sixth king of that dynasty. And another period of Babylon that's later than wait a minute. Yeah, then the next major period. Well, let me go to that, back to that book. I can find it better if I do. Well, the earliest Babylonians were the dynasty of Akkad. And it was the first empire, or they had empirical leanings. They were never really a fully engaged empire, but they tried to be one. The dynasty of Akkad is from 2334 to 2154. This is the third millennium. And they ruled after the first wave of the kings of Sumer, which are not Babylonian, technically. Well, it's interesting that Syriologists routinely refer to the whole thing as Babylonia. So you have the dynasty of Akkad. Then you have the third dynasty of Ur, which is Sumerian. And then the first dynasty of Assin, which may or may not be Babylonian. It does sound like they're Babylonian because the Babylonian kings have kings like Ishbi-Era, very Babylonian, Shu, Elishu, Idin, Dagon, Ishme, Dagon, Lipit, Ishtar, Ur, Ninurta, and then they get kind of mixed with Sumerian names. And then you have Lagash, which I think is a mixture of Babylonia and Sumer. Larsa dynasty, which tends to be more Babylonian, but it has Sumerian god names, so it's hard to tell. And then you have the first dynasty of Babylon, which we know to be Amorite. Then the Kassite dynasty. We're not sure where the Kassites came from, but they were not Babylonian. And then you have the second dynasty of Isin, which is Babylonian. And then you have the second dynasty of the Sealand, which have Babylonian names, but they probably aren't really Babylonian in origin. The dynasty of Bazi, the Elamite dynasty, very briefly. Dynasty of E, which is Babylonian, apparently, but we're not sure. The textbook, or I should say the book I read on the history of Babylon, did not seem to think there was any other group that were Babylonian except the second Isin group. It was the one time the Babylonians ruled themselves. You have the ninth dynasty of Babylon, the Chaldean dynasty. The Chaldeans were not originally Babylonian. They settled in southern Babylon. I'm going through that to tell you that what happened is that every single group, foreign group, that ruled Babylon held on to the traditions, the culture, and the religion, and the political systems of Babylon.
Of the previous groups?
Well, all the groups held on to the Babylonian tradition, so that it was pretty constant through all of them. It was amazing. It had tremendous power over the incoming kings who weren't historically Babylonian.
It perseveres. It's adapted. It mutates.
It seemed that Marduk became the god of Babylon, the patron god of Babylon, there was no turning back, because Marduk was known for his rage. And they didn't dare.
So in
In
theory,
fact, if I may tell a story first to illustrate that. Sennacherib destroyed Babylon, took Marduk. It took his bed, mind you, to Ashur and put him before the god Ashur so that the god Ashur could use Marduk's bed. Sennacherib, not terribly long after that, gets slain. And that so discombobulated his son, who was successor to the throne, Esarhaddon, that he tried to restore Marduk's bed, but he didn't get it. He didn't really get it done. And it was his son Ashurbanipal that finally restored Marduk's bed. And Esarhaddon tried very hard to undo what his father had done to Marduk. That's how powerful a god Marduk was. But you had something you wanted to ask.
Well,
Floyd.
Okay, when you're talking about the power of Marduk, is that facilitated through the priests who take care of him? In other words, are the priests really the ones behind controlling the kings?
Mm-mm. They may have some, because there's the Akitu ritual where the king is dragged by the priest by the ear in before Marduk, forced to kneel. In other words, he's not allowed to have freedom to walk in and do this. He's dragged in, forced to kneel. And then he says to the king, the priest says, "Have you treated the Babylonians well over the past year?" The Ketu festival had to do with the new year. And the king was supposed to say, "I have faithfully been very mindful of my people and have taken good care of them over the past year." And then the priest, when the priest first drags him in, he takes a staff and he strikes him on the cheek. And then again, after he makes this proclamation, after the king makes the proclamation, "I have done right by the Babylonians," then the priest strikes him again on the cheek. And if the tears flow, it means he's okay with Marduk. But if the tears do not flow, Marduk is angry with the king, and he will make him suffer by probably putting him to death by armed forces or whatever. You can imagine how the priests could tweak that. You know, if they didn't like the king, they could just tap him on the cheek. And if the tears didn't flow, well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently, this religion was such a religion of fear that it wasn't. That the priests wouldn't necessarily do that because they might get punished by Marduk if they cheated. And so you have this very powerful religion that's based on fear that is just, it's a stronghold of Babylon through all the ups and downs.
Which is the opposite of love.
Yes.
So maybe that's why it keeps showing up, both historically and why it keeps showing up. I was just, we've been reading, I read someplace the Bible references Babylon like over 200 times in the Bible.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
I've never counted them.
You know, that's like, oh, well, it's interesting. So based on fear.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
If I'm hearing you right.
Yeah.
Doesn't go, he's gonna die.
I mean, the only prayer I know of that pleads for appeasement over and over again is the prayer to Marduk during the Ketu festival. The priest prays the prayer, "Be appeased, Marduk, be appeased, be appeased, Marduk, be appeased," over and over.
Sounds like a Hail
it's
Mary.
Not, There's other things in the prayer, but that appeasement is central.
I don't know if we're directly mentioning this, but it seems interesting to me that if the deceiver is trying to deceive people, what's the primary thing he's trying to deceive them about if it isn't the definition of love? You have to appease your God because that's the loving thing to do.
Well, let me talk about love since you brought that up. God, as a loving God, well, let me first talk about Father. God as Father is only mentioned 17 times in the Old Testament. And it's always, almost always, about his character. Like as a father pities his children, so does the Lord pity those who fear him.
So it's tangential.
That's because in the house of the Father in the second millennium, you have the Father as a hierarchical figure of dominance. It's all about dominance. So how does God get through to people that he's like a father if the Father is not like him? So that's why there's so few references. Now I've come to love. Love was co-opted by the Assyrians in their treaties as a treaty term. I'm not spotting the book. I always have trouble finding it. But the treaty, the succession treaty of Esarhaddon, no, of Ashurbanipal, but it's Esarhaddon's treaty. He knows he's going to die. He's got to get everything in line for his son, Ashurbanipal, to be king and not have any trouble with his rivals, which are his brothers. And so he establishes this treaty with his subjects, which include his vassals. And partway through the treaty, he says, you are to love Ashurbanipal. This is not the kind of love of compassion and mercy and kindness. This is not the kind of love Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 13. This is treaty loyalty.
Yes.
Whether you like him or not, whether you fear him or not, you love him.
Code for do what he says.
Yes.
This sounds like the kind of love I was raised on.
Yeah.
So that's why love is not connected with God very many times in the Old Testament. In fact, when God makes his name known to Moses, he does not mention love as an attribute. He mentions chesed. Chesed is sometimes translated as love. And scholars have debated that term so much because it seems to vary from time period to time period and document to document in the Bible. In some time periods, it seemed to mean loyalty. Chesed seemed to be a treaty. But in other time periods, it meant kindness. I'm trying to think of the actual term. Unfailing love, things like that. I have the hunch from what I have not done a complete concordant study of this term. It's the term chesed. I have a hunch that doing chesed to someone is doing what is not, that's going beyond what is legally required to show mercy. That it has mercy in its attributes, but it's bigger than just mercy.
How do you spell that word?
Chesed.
Chesed.
K.
You could write it C H E S E D.
But what better way to malign the character of God? If God is love, just change the definition of love to be one of.
Well, what happens is if we don't actively seek God as he is, which is love, we lose love. We stop, and then we use, first we make it as an obligation. You have to love me. Then you put it under threat. Love me or I'll kill you. Then you put it in a very restricted legal context. Do treaty loyalty.
Well, and then you don't even have to tie it to relationship. You can love ice cream.
Exactly.
And that's
Exactly.
pretty trivial. Who cares about whether you love ice cream or not? That doesn't change your life. You could say the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Bible Project, when you said that word, the Bible Project does a word study with a short video, and they say Kesed, K-H-E-S-E-D.
K-H is another way you can...
K-H-E-S-E-D.
And that's just simply so you pronounce it correctly instead of...
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So how would you pronounce it? You said Kesed?
Kesed. Kesed.
So it was very well done, because when you said that, I go, I've heard that word. Can't remember how to spell it or say it, but
I spell it differently because like K-H is usually used with a kaf Hebrew letter, which is a K. And Kesed is usually spelled H with a dot under it.
Okay.
Into if you're using transliteration of Hebrew.
They call it loyal love. So if anybody wants to look at that.
And that's, to me, that is only a partial take on that word. Because God does use that in his Yahweh, Yahweh, a God, gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth. Showing chesed, I believe, is what it says.
So those, that transition of how to define love really brings it back around to, well, love is simply just obey me. Or else.
Yeah.
Or else. Especially the or else.
Yeah, especially the or else.
A command without any freedom, which is opposite of love.
Right.
Yeah, freedom is the one thing that's least discussed in almost all of religion. Unless it's like a counterfeit freedom where you can just do whatever you feel like and God's going to save you anyway. You know, that's maybe one reason why people don't talk about freedom that much, is because even the word freedom has been hijacked. But true freedom of choice is one of the least discussed topics I've heard. And I think it's not an accident, because if you don't believe in freedom, which is pretty fast evaporating in the world, then the only thing left is an arbitrary God.
Or, as you have a lot in Babylonia and Assyria, love is purely sexual and sensual.
A feeling and not a verb. An emotion, not a verb.
A feeling.
Yeah.
So does that transition into the harvest? Are the harvests dependent on a view of God?
Well, it's hard to do this as an overview and not start getting into the details. But you notice that the harvest is not forced into being ripe. It just ripens. It ripens under the sun with the help of a little bit of rain, if you're using Israelite agriculture.
So then the question is, why are there two harvests? Why is there discrepancies between the harvesters? Why is there obvious stark differences between the results of the harvest. And most of that will be in the details, but, you know, looking at it from a larger perspective as an overview, it might be helpful to at least tease out a little bit of, you know, why? Why are there two?
Well, aren't there the sheep and the goats? Or the wheat and the tares?
Those who rest and those who don't. That's in this chapter.
What it means is that everybody reaches perfection. If you read perfection as maturity, both evil and good reaches perfection.
Maturity, ripeness, another way of harvest.
And which harvest ripens first?
I'm not a farmer. Can anybody tell me that? Grapes ripen in September, October.
So wheat's before that, at least in our...
Wheat before that. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Weeds?
Wheats.
I think weeds are before weeds.
Weeds are constant.
Yeah.
This particular harvest, these two harvests aren't about wheat. Weeds, they're about wheat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, they're about wheat and grapes.
Mm-hmm.
I see is the flow in this book, and after spending quite a bit of time on these two harvests, trying to probe into every little minutia and detail to see what clues might come out, I see them connected to the three angels' messages. That the three angels' messages actually is what ripens the harvest. And so coming out of the three angels' messages, you have the first harvest, which I think is, you can pretty confidently say the harvester is Jesus. I mean, there's just not any clues there to discredit that for the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the harvest is clean. I mean, you know, there's nothing negative. There's no blood. It's just clean. And it's quick and it's simple. And they're harvested. Mm-hmm. So that's really nice. But then, you know, I really struggled with the second harvest because I initially thought, well, maybe Satan's doing the harvesting. That doesn't fit real well. But that was my initial approach. And then as I look closer and closer and closer at the little details of who said what and where they came from and all that stuff between these two harvests, I came up with probably a very novel approach, which seems to work for me anyway. You know, it takes quite a bit of explaining, but I concluded that the harvester in the second harvest were those who had just been harvested in the first harvest. And then they are conducting the second harvest. They're carrying out the second harvest. And again, that would take some explaining, but that's what I saw. And then these two harvests are actually a synopsis of the next few chapters. The first harvest is expanded on and explained in the next chapter. And then the second harvest is expanded on in the chapter after that. And maybe even several more chapters. And then as a rerun, those next two chapters are expanded on even more in the next few chapters. So it's like you start with a seed that has everything in it, and then you unpack that a little bit, and then you go back and re-unpack it even more expansively. And that seems to work quite well.
I'm looking for the harvest of the wheat and the tares. Isn't it in Matthew?
Matthew 13,
thank you. That's the parable of the soils.
Well, this one says, well, I just did it big time, wheat and tares.
No, that's the wheat and tares.
Oh, the parable of the weeds. Yes, here it is.
Well, he slept
and
he ate tares.
The one who plants the good seed is the human one. The field is the world, and the good seeds and the follow are the followers of the kingdom, but the weeds are the followers of the evil one. The enemy who planted them is the devil.
Told you. The enemy's done it. The weeds.
The harvest is at the end of the present age. The harvesters are the angels.
Yes. Yes. And I see that second harvest as being harvested by the seven angels in the next chapter. But I also concluded after studying 15 very closely that those seven angels are representative of the 144,000. And they're acting on behalf of the Lamb, who is the first harvester. And they're simply emulating and just reflecting the Lamb in carrying out a global harvest, which is happening in chapter 16. And of course, angels simply means messengers. Because we've never argued over whether the three angels' message is given by angels or by people.
No, that's more for the details, I think.
Right. But I think the same thing should be allowed to be used for other messages, as in the seven angels. They very possibly could represent people as well.
Well, we're supposed to give the three angels messages, so.
Right.
Yeah, and we're people.
Right. Anyway, that's my big take on the two harvests.
One of the things, this is the back shift here to something much, much earlier. But the three angels fly in mid-heaven.
Mm-hmm.
That's different than the angel in chapter 10. It comes down from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And if you compare that with the early chapters of Revelation, that the one who comes down from heaven would be Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the thought that Revelation portrays Jesus coming down from heaven, or the angel that comes down from heaven that starts the last movement. And then in chapter 18, after this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. Same angel as in chapter 10. But we can wait on that to discuss it until we get to chapter 18.
So next week we can start with 144,000.
I would think we would start with Revelation 14:1 and do the details.
Yeah.
And then that process we would discuss the 144,000.
Right, right. Yeah, I love that, those first five verses. There is so much in there.
So why don't I think we're coming to a climax. It's interesting here in chapter 19. So the angel swung his sickle into the earth and cut the vineyard of the earth. That's not how you cut grapes for harvest. It's like a giant sickle going whoosh. They're all down.
Sounds like he's cutting the vines as well as the grapes, huh?
It seems like it. Because it says cut the vineyard of the earth. He cut the vineyard of the earth.
Don't they cut the bunches off with something?
They do. They do, but
might that not they wouldn't well call, be a sickle?
They yes. Yes, but they don't cut the vineyard, you know, they cut the branches so that the branches can grow back. But this is ending the vineyard. I mean, it sounds like to me.
Looks like a little paring knife from what I've watched when they're harvesting grapes.
Oh, yeah.
A little hook end, and it's just a pressure with a thumb, and off it comes, clumps of grapes.
You'll have to notice that, Gene, since you live right.
I know. I should go out there in September, October, and try to watch them harvest the grapes.
But I appreciated what you said, Floyd, about the harvest follows the three announcements and does get more specific as we go into Revelation. And, you know, the harvest just so fits with what the Bible describes. You reap what you sow. There is a maturing process that ultimately has ultimate consequences. So it would make sense that they talk about harvest, but they are very different kind of harvest. Those who have rest, those who don't have rest, those who, you know, ultimately experience eternal life, and those who are separated from God. So I like how, as we're worshiping this designer God who created all of reality, again, it uses, you know, this analogy of a harvest. So it fits, you reap what you sow, which it's God doesn't have to do something to me. The choices I make have their inherent consequences.
Right.
And some of those consequences are good and some of them are not good. So God isn't, you know, authoritarily doing something to these individuals. He's just acknowledging, this is grain, this is grapes, this is, you know.
And Jesus says, I judge no one, but there is a judge. And that judge is the words that I have spoken to you. They will be your judge. And that is the reaping process.
Yes.
He speaks truth.
Mm-hmm.
He's just saying, no man can see my face and live, Moses. You don't know what you're asking.
Because the torment of the wicked are that they have rejected the truth. And when the truth finally breaks through all their deception, clouds of deception, and gets through to them, they, because they are so settled into the other way of looking at God, they are, in a sense, reaped.
I was going to say, back on the reaping thing and the sickle, Jonathan's take on it doesn't seem to leave me with the impression of a scorched earth. It's more is basically just, hey, it's harvest time. Let's go down and bring in the harvest.
Okay. It couldn't.
And I also left a note here that said the wine press does not seem to be a place of punishment, but of transformation and the result of the harvest. So we don't need to look at this as a negative thing. It's actually God coming down and say, okay, it's time to bring the people home. At least that's another way of looking at it.
Exactly.
It's time.
And, you know, when God comes to that point, if there's sheep and goats, there's nothing he says that changes a goat to a sheep or a sheep to a goat. They are what they are by their own choice. He just acknowledges who's who.
Let him that is righteous be righteous still. Let him who is holy be holy still. Let him who is unrighteous be unrighteous still.
Yep. The word that I have spoken. Back to Floyd's verse.
If one takes 17 through 19 as a positive, it changes the reading of 20 quite a bit. The blood flowed out of the winepress at the height of a horse's bridle at a distance of 1,600 strata. I mean, that sounds pretty gruesome, but if you harvest grapes to make wine out of them, that's what's going to happen to the good ones. They're going to be made into wine. I don't know. That's something I hadn't really put together before.
Well, and Jesus is such an artist at using allegories. Everything he teaches is in the form of an allegory that is common to the cultural context of the people he's speaking to. So they get it in ways that I can't begin to comprehend.
Jean looks like she's thinking about something.
I'm just looking at the text here. It does seem that there are two separate harvests that have two separate uses. And I think if we don't take these literally instead of symbolically, I don't think we can get away around the fact that there are two different maturation processes going on.
Right.
And those maturation processes are going on because of the three angels' messages. I agree with Floyd that the three angels' messages are the ones that bring the ripening of the harvest. I think we need to study how do they do that? What is it about those messages that brings the ripening?
And the clues of that are
wheat and the tares be applicable here?
Yeah, that's what I was just reading a little bit ago. Is the wheat and the tares.
When by allegories, the wheat and the tares, the harvest.
So those are some of the questions I hope we pursue next week, starting next week. I think we've locked our brain, rot our brains over this material enough today that we need a break, mental break. Until next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. Let's have closing prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you that as we have wrestled with scripture, as we have attempted to understand it, that you have been with us in the journey, as you always are. We ask that you will continue to be with us as we, our minds still work on it, even when we're not thinking about it, and processing it during the week. May we be able to understand more fully and appreciate more fully how you do things, how you change us, how you transform us, and how the opposite takes place, where we end up becoming mature in evil. We pray that this will become clear. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Amen.